Alright, hi again everyone. It's been a while. Well, actually it's been like 2 minutes tops. We were just with John Wheatley, and now we are with Steven Kangas. Hi!
Hi!
So, as we said before, Stefan is co-maintainer now of... is it the entire Emacs project? How do you describe this?
Yeah, co-maintainer of GNU Emacs.
Right, perfect. So you know what? Because I'm sure everyone is dying to hear everything you've got to say in your presentation, I'm just going to shut up now and leave the floor to you. Do you need to share your screen or anything?
No.
Okay, great. No, well, I'll just cut my webcam off. I'll still be in the background, so do not hesitate. If you've got any problem, I'm still around. And I'll see you, just beacon whenever you're done, and I'll show up with the questions. All right?
Thank you, Leo. And thank you everyone for being here. I'm Steven Kangas. So as Leo explained, I am recently appointed as a co-maintainer of GNU Emacs, which a role that I'm fulfilling currently with Eli Suretsky, who's been co-maintainer for quite some time. So I got the question to be a co-maintainer from Richard in August this year, and of course when you get a question like that, I couldn't not say yes. So here we are. I can't tell you how excited I am to have this opportunity to address the community in this way. I'm really humbled, of course, to be part of it, and to be able to serve the community in this capacity. I've used Emacs, I think many of you might also have used Emacs for quite some time, but I'm going on 2 decades as an Emacs user, and my involvement in Emacs Lisp development is, I mean, almost as long, but my core development goes back only 4 or 5 years. I have to also thank the EmacsConf organizers, who are doing, I think, a tremendous job and have done a tremendous job over the years in really building and strengthening what I think is this fantastic community of users and developers and people interested in Emacs. I actually had the chance to meet up with Eli Suretsky, as well as another Emacs hacker, Andrea Corallo, when I was at the GNU project's 40 years celebration, 40 years since the GNU project was announced. And it was very inspiring in general to meet people. And I think EmacsConf should also, I think, serve to inspire and sort of help bring something to the type of work that we're many of us are doing to improve Emacs, whether it's in package development or in core, to bring out the new and exciting ideas and get people enthusiastic about Emacs, about hacking on Emacs. This is my little attempt to contribute with, let's say, 2 things. I will first try to present how we do Emacs core development and why we've done some of the choices that we have. Because we have seen at times that perhaps people aren't always clear on this or that aspect. So maybe this will be enlightening. I will also try to present some kind of vision for what Emacs could be with your help. Emacs is already very good, as we all know, but we could be even better. That's the reality of any type of software development. So the overall idea of this talk is to tell you, if you're an Emacs Lisp package developer today, why you should become an Emacs core developer, and the sort of steps that you might want to take to do that, or how you can help Emacs core development. Even if you're just a user and you found a bug, report it. Perhaps you have a feature request that you'd like to discuss. I think we need more interaction in general between Emacs core developers, typically on emacsdevil@gnu.org, the mailing list that we use to coordinate our development efforts, between Emacs Devil, package developers, and users. Because there is so much great stuff really going on in the community. But I think sometimes the step to core development seems big and perhaps even a little bit scary. So I'm hoping to be able to help bridge that gap, even if just a little bit. We need more people contributing to Emacs itself. And also a small disclaimer here. In this talk, I will only be able to speak for myself, not for GNU or the Emacs project, even if it's like a little bit more official. But I will also try to give the view of the project where it makes sense to do so. Keep in mind, I'm only one of the maintainers, the co-maintainer together with Eli, and I can't just make decisions arbitrarily. In a sense, I'm as a co-maintainer and trusted as a steward, entrusted by, of course, the GNU project, but also by the community, that we really can't just take decisions, I think, arbitrarily, even if it sometimes perhaps may seem so, or it may feel that way. We really have to realize that we can't just push too much of just a personal agenda to the extent that it doesn't line up with what is best for Emacs going forward, and the more overall picture of that. So there are limitations to come with the job, if you like. One question I actually got this week when I started a new assignment at work, and I got the question, you know, when I said I'm involved in Emacs development, and then someone asked, oh, is Emacs still developed? Isn't it done almost? And I answered to that, yes, we are still around. We're going on 40 years now as a software project. Not many projects actually can claim that type of longevity, but Emacs is among those few that can. And of course, we have had some very exciting developments in recent versions. I think John just gave you an update on that. But we had, I mean, just some highlights out of many highlights that you could give. Really, we got the tree sitter support in Emacs 29 that we now need to sort of extend and develop. We have merged eglot, so we have LSP support out of the box. I think it's a huge improvement. Native compilation, of course, a big feature. That was Andrea's job really for performance. And that it turns out that in many types of workloads and the types of stuff that people are doing, it often matters. And we're hoping to make that the default, perhaps already in Emacs 30. So there are things that are happening that fundamentally make Emacs better at a very core level. So of course, why wouldn't you want to be involved in such an exciting and I think dynamic project? How is Emacs developed? Well, this is, I think, perhaps to some people, a little bit more of a threshold, if you like, because I think all of us know really that there is exciting and cool stuff that is going on in Emacs and has been going on over the last couple of years, and we'll see even more of that, I think, going forward. One thing is that communication still takes place over a mailing list in 2023. So we have emacsdevil@gnu.org, and that's where we develop Emacs. We send patches back and forth, we comment on patches. And actually, this workflow is very good if you're used to it. Because guess what? As Emacs users, we like doing everything we can in Emacs, especially the core tasks that we're doing, such as developing. Emacs itself. Of course, you want to do that fully within Emacs. So we hack Emacs Lisp in Emacs, we hack C in Emacs, we respond to emails also from Emacs, respond to bug reports, manage bug reports. We do all that stuff very, very smoothly. And it doesn't really matter, in a sense, what is the medium. It happens to be email. Technically, it could be anything, but email really has that type of staying power where we've been able to use it for a long time. And this is how, and we're still able to use it. And this is how free software was always developed in the past. Only in the last, let's say, 10, 15 years, we've had, you know, more development taking place perhaps on forges like, you know, GitHub, GitLab, whatever. But we are one of the holdouts. I mean, there are others, of course, like the Linux kernel has mailing lists. They're not trying to do that scale development on GitHub. And this is not just because we're Luddites that, you know, refuse to change. We just have to do it in the old way because it is the old way and that's the way it should be. No, it's actually because we as core developers, the core development team and the people already involved and doing tremendous, I mean, large amounts of work in Emacs has very efficient workflows built up based on this. So, of course, I mean, moving to something else is something that we might like to do, but we're not yet clear on how to do it exactly and what to move to. So these are the types of discussions that we're looking at. Can we still support a mailing, an email type workflow while moving to something else? That would be one of the big ones. I think another thing that trips people up is that we use the bug tracker that, I mean, maybe some people, I've heard people say it's archaic. It's called Debugs. I think maybe Debugs gets a bit of a bad rep. I think Debugs is a good piece of software. It wasn't developed in 2023. I mean, that much is clear. It's a little bit older, but it really is a workhorse of the Debian project, which is obviously a project that's developed in a very different way than Emacs is. It's on a completely different scale, of course, much bigger, many more developers and so on. But I think the developers did a good job, you know, for the time, but it might be showing its age, perhaps in places, perhaps, you know, again, it's the email workflow and people see that as sort of a little bit of a threshold. It seems alien. It's a little bit strange, the types of workflows that you have there. So we are seeing some limitations with debugs. And again, how do you report bugs? Well, in a sense, it's easier. You send an email to bug-gnu.emacs@gnu.org, and you copy in whatever you get from, you know, report Emacs bug, or if you have, you know, send mail set up locally, just hit Control-C, Control-C, and it's sent to the bug tracker, and that's fine. Also, I have to mention that there is this very good package on GNU Alpas. If you're ever trying to read the Emacs bug tracker, you know, or following along in Emacs development, I really recommend install the package Debugs from GNU Alpa. It's so good. And again, you know, it's built on GNU. It's all integrated in Emacs. It's so much better than using the web and so on. And if you really want to get into it, you can download the bug tracker archives and the mailing list archives, and you can put them locally, you can have them searchable, and you can have whatever experience you like. So, I mean, it's really a flexible workflow, but it's a bit strange perhaps to some people. So we also think, you know, having this, supporting only this workflow might be a little bit too limiting. So we do want to move over to something like, you know, GitLab, perhaps Source Hut or something similar. We've had a couple discussions about that over the last, you know, couple of years. I think even before that, but, you know, that's how far back, you know, I've been involved, and definitely it's come up occasionally. I think we are less far away than perhaps ever is how I would express that. And in the sense that I think there are the remaining blockers for just making the shift, let's say, are, I think, I mean, first of all, we're talking about limitations perhaps in this software. They're well-defined. and they're not insurmountable. I don't think they have to be in any case. We should be able to make some progress. The main thing that we're lacking now is not, you know, more discussion or more, you know, people, you know, with, you know, prodding us to just please switch over. No, we're looking for volunteers. If you think that you, you know, have what it takes to sort of come in and help us do something like that and work together with us, you know, to see what can be done, perhaps a few things would need to be changed in GitLab. You know, I don't think anything huge, but, you know, maybe there are some patches to be written and sent upstream, or maybe we need to do some local hacks or whatever. If you want to do that, please contact us, emacsdevil. We'll be very happy to talk to you. And then we can start making progress. So I'm really hoping that something like that will come into place. But we need to, if we do switch over, we need to preserve, you know, the good parts of our email-based workflow. So there are requirements there so that we can continue to do our job as maintainers, if you like. Another thing is that we've sometimes seen that, you know, there's a bit of a, like, a different culture perhaps on mailing lists and on Emacs Devil than what many people are used to, especially, like, you've used, perhaps, you know, many people might be in university and they've used, you know, started using Emacs, maybe got into a little bit of, you know, package development and, you know, starting to get the ropes of that and, you know, are very used to working on places like, you know, GitLab or something like that. Then the type of, you know, culture and way of communicating that we use in Emacs might, you know, be a little bit different. And of course, it's different in the sense that, you know, mailing lists have always, you know, I mean, let's say hacker culture, whatever you want to call it, have always communicated in a particular way using mailing lists. So it's like succinct, to the point, perhaps skipping a few pleasantries. And the idea is that, you know, you should just use it in as effective way as possible, so that also, you know, the archives are usable. And the other thing is that generally people involved in, you know, developing free software has to deal with a lot of incoming, you know, traffic, emails, you know, like, it's just they don't have the bandwidth if it's too much noise. So you really need to be strict to keep the signal to noise ratio high. We have some weird terminology on the Emacs Devil. Some people tell us, I mean, we say sometimes install patches, which basically means push to master, or, you know, merge pull requests, because we've used other version control systems in the past where it might make more sense to say install patches. And then you sort of, I don't know, I say it, don't ask me why, but it feels natural after a while. You install a patch, it's clear what you mean. You don't have to worry about which branch it's on. So it's a little bit historical there. So there is some of that culture going on that might be different. We don't use emojis that much. That's another thing. We don't. There's no, like, you know, you can't click the little like button at the bottom of a comment or an email as you could on GitHub. But, you know, there are exceptions, and it's not like someone will send you angry emails if you use an emoji or something like that. But, you know, it can come off as, perhaps, you know, because people are pressed for time also when replying to all these emails. So it might come off as a bit short, but that's just how it is. And I think we have heard this comment before, that, you know, mailing lists are scary, or Emacs Devil is scary, or, you know, core development is scary. And I mean, I've touched a few of these points a little bit already. I think, yeah, I mean, maybe a little bit. For example, we don't use emojis, very short in the communication. We always use, you know, correct grammar and spelling. We take that seriously because it's important for, you know, being clear in your written communication. When all you have is written communication, is really important. You know, it's not like if you come in there and you don't know all these cultural rules and all these patterns, then, you know, you will. We won't talk to you. No, actually, we try to be as welcoming as we can, and be mindful. And, you know, people, not everyone has English as their native language, for example. So perhaps someone says something and it might come off as, you know, rude, but maybe it's just a direct translation. So we try to give a lot of, you know, from whatever the native language is. So we try to give a lot of, you know, leeway and just be a little bit, you know, flexible and focus on, you know, the key points, which are the technical things, the technical decisions, technical arguments, rather than, you know, getting bogged down in a lot of, you know, personal, you know, discussions and flame wars. So, I mean, there are these things to be aware of, you know, it's just a little bit different. I don't think it's anything huge and I wouldn't be, you know, I think it would be sad if people felt too intimidated by that. It just is what it is. And if you spend some time there, you'll see how people generally communicate. Sometimes, you know, there are a lot of people on Emacs level. It's a public mailing list. A lot of people, you know, just sign up to follow Emacs development. Sometimes they chime in. And I think this is in general a good thing. I think it should be, you know, a public mailing list. Sometimes this leads to weird situations from, I mean, just the point of view as an Emacs maintainer, right? I mean, I try to say something and it doesn't always say, oh, he's the maintainer or whatever. So when I say something, it should carry a little bit more weight than some unknown person from the internet who has an opinion and decided to send it to Emacs Devil. So it's good to be a little bit aware of, you know, who is a little bit more involved with the project. I would check out the maintainers file. I would check, you know, see in the Git log, you know, do these people actually have anything in core? And if not, maybe, you know, we won't really, even if they express an opinion very strongly, even if they're a little bit rude, maybe they're not even involved in Emacs development. I mean, often that's the case. We have some people, unfortunately, at times, we have random people from the internet come in on the mailing list and they're just a little bit rude, or they say an opinion that's not exactly helpful. And, you know, I think you need to be aware. I mean, these things happen in any forum, but it happens on Emacs Devil as well. So just be a little bit, you know, aware of who you're talking to, you know, what people are doing. You know, it can help to check the archives, see who writes or what and so on. But it's not something that I think is a huge problem. But it's just, again, something to be aware of. We have the GNU kind communication guidelines in place, which basically says that, you know, you should be nice to people and, you know, stay focused on the technical problem, try to see things from another person's point of view, this kind of stuff. So we're really trying to be as inclusive as possible and just stay, you know, correct in general. And sometimes, I mean, not everyone, it's a public list. We moderate it, but not to a huge extent, right? So sometimes people get away with a little bit of perhaps, you know, stretching the boundaries of what might be included in the kind communication guidelines, you know, the fences or limitations of that. But I would just ignore that. Sometimes it happens that we, you know, as happens in any forum, by the way, just we have these very big threads. We start discussing something else. Perhaps you send us a patch and it just devolves into us discussing something completely different. And of course, I partake in that, so I'm not better than anyone else, but it just happens. And just, I mean, it's not your fault. It's just what happens sometimes in forums, and don't mind that. And it's a little bit easier to do that in emails because you just change the subject and now it's supposed to be a different thread, but it comes as replies usually to you, which, you know, wouldn't happen perhaps in a different workflow. So it's something to be aware of as well. Another thing is that, of course, in written communication, tone doesn't always come across. If someone sounds negative, sometimes it's just them being neutral. Sometimes, you know, you get no replies. You send something, you get no replies. And this could mean, you know, yeah, what you said was uncontroversial. We think it's a good idea. There, no one replied to it because either someone thought someone else would reply or just there was no need to reply because, yeah, why not? But if you do send a patch and you don't get an answer, wait, I mean, don't wait 1-2 days. Maybe we're, you know, busy or sick or whatever. Wait 2 weeks, it's fine to just send it again. If you send the patch to Emacs Devil, send it to the bug mailing list because we lose track of stuff on Emacs Devil. That's just the reality of it. So if you propose making a change and no one commented, feel free to ask us again if a patch would be welcome, and we will clarify. Bug reports, unfortunately, if you get no answer, I mean, we do have a limited amount of time to work on bugs. If you're looking to get started in Emacs development, this is an excellent way to start getting involved. What I'd recommend is, you know, start looking into bugs. I'd install debugs. I'd see about, you know, the mailing workflow, set that up a little bit or not. You know, it's up to you. You can reply to an email without setting any of that stuff up. But just help us try edge bugs, send patches, do that type of stuff. I mean, that's an excellent way and extremely welcome. We're so happy to see when people, you know, pick up bug reports that have been left by the wayside and just fix them, send us a patch, and we can just apply it. So that's really your starting point if you want to get involved in Emacs core development. Yeah. I also want to say that be aware that, you know, Emacs is the editor of the GNU operating system, and this makes the project political a little bit, whether you like it or not. Luckily, the politics are limited enough that we can find broad agreement on it. So we want to promote, we want to create free software. That's sort of it. That's it, and there shouldn't be too much more to it, right? We want to rid the world of proprietary software as, you know, an evil thing. Ideally, all software should be free. But these are just the goals of the free software movement. So we're very strict with some things. We don't recommend non-free proprietary software. Of course, we have no problem mentioning Microsoft Windows because everyone knows that there is this, you know, I don't know, obscure operating system developed in California that some people insist on using. We use, you know, many of us use GNU plus Linux. Actually, some core developers happen to use exactly, you know, not GNU plus Linux, but that's fine as well, right? We take a little bit of a pragmatic view, but what we don't want to do is promote like this small unknown piece of non-free software and sort of help the non-free software in that way. That's where we try to draw the line, expressed in just a few words. So that's one thing. We're, I think, very pragmatic on this point, but we do try to follow the principle. We also require copyright assignment, and I think in general there's the argument is, right, that we require a copyright assignment because that makes it easier to defend the legal status of the GNU Emacs source code. So if there is ever a legal battle, the idea is that if it's only one copyright holder and you have a GPL violation, i.e. someone might distribute, you know, change Emacs and then distribute it as proprietary software or something nasty like that, then we have an easier way of defending it in court if there is only one copyright holder. So we assign copyright to the Free Software Foundation. And I think there, I mean, sometimes people oppose this for various reasons. You know, people see it as, you know, maybe some people might say, you know, it's ideological. GNU goes, you know, the FSF goes too far with this. And I mean, that's fine. That's an opinion. And then other people are more practical. You know, it's a hassle, basically. We don't want to sign these papers. And I'm not really here to tell anyone that they're wrong. I've expressed my views on this in the past. But just for now, I'm just very practical for the purposes of this talk. So I signed the papers. It didn't take me many minutes, and in most cases it shouldn't really. And it's something that I found worth doing because that way I could, you know, focus on continuing to improve Emacs instead of, you know, discussing the finer points of copyright law. I could write patches instead, that kind of thing. So, I mean, this is something that trips people up, and you know, it's fine that people have different opinions on it and so on. But I think for now, that's just something to be aware of. So there's much more that could be said. Ideally, I would like to have a practical part to this talk as well. But I wanted to say something about the packages in Emacs, because as we know, I mean, Emacs is I can't remember what it says. It's like a visual, there's in the manual, it says, oh, Emacs is an advanced text editor. It's visual, which, I mean, it's not ed, the old Unix ed, so that's cool. It's also customizable, right? So that's always been a thing. And what makes Emacs so amazing. And some people described it as, I can't remember who said that there's been a Cambrian explosion of packages in Emacs. And I think that's true. I mean, if you look at something like Melpa, I think they have over 5,000 packages now. It's like truly impressive, just an immense amount of work, an immense amount of packages. And, you know, really, like, this shows the strength, I think, of the Emacs community, of Emacs itself as an idea. And I think it's also just the tremendous work that's been done by the Melpa maintainers. And they do get a lot of recognition for that, and rightly so, in my opinion. It's done so much, I think, for our community. The other package archive that we have is GNU Elpa, and that's been enabled since when packages first got introduced back in, I think, Emacs, was it 23? And probably, I mean, the main thing why a package goes onto GNU Elpa is, you know, it should be installable out of the box. So, I mean, that's a big benefit in a sense. It's also a requirement for GNU Elpa that the copyright, again, just as GNU Emacs, the copyright is assigned to the Free Software Foundation. And some, you know, very hugely popular packages, like YaSnippet, for example, is on GNU Elpa. And we were discussing this just, you know, 2 months back. And Joe Tavora, I can't say his name, G-O-A-O, Tavora, he made the point that, you know, he's never seen a problem in any of his packages that, you know, with copyright assignment in particular. It's never been a problem to get people to be involved in the development of those packages just because of the copyright assignment requirements. So, I mean, that's his perspective on that. And I think it's worth relating his experience here. We also have this new package archive called non-GNU Elpa, which is now enabled by default as well. I think for practical purposes, you could get into it a little bit more, you know, why we created non-GNU Elpa and what, you know, perhaps, you know, that's something we could discuss in the Q&A section. For practical purposes, the main thing to be aware of is, yes, we don't promote non-free software on there. And we also don't have the copyright assignment requirement. I think this is probably for new packages. It's generally, you know, better if they go to GNU Elpa. If there is any type of idea or ambition that, you know, at some point it would be good, or it might be good to eventually have some type of functionality like this shipped with Emacs itself. So I think this is something that, you know, perhaps package authors could also be aware of, that occasionally, you know, we do bring in functionality from GNU Elpa into core Emacs because we feel that it should be better integrated with Emacs itself. If I could give any type of recommendation, of course you do, these are your packages, right? I would, in an ideal world, we would only use this for, you know, legacy packages where people contributed in the past, but you didn't worry about the copyright assignment. But where possible, I think there is benefit in putting it on GNU Elpa. And I wanted to end a little bit on a more, you know, the more opinionated, perhaps, part of my talk, and not just talk about processes. I see that I'm running out of time. So I would say Emacs is hackable, and I think that's, you know, a blessing and a curse. And if you think about something like, you know, the types of choices that you can make, perhaps, when you implement something. There are different choices between something like Common Lisp, which is like bare, more batteries included, and something like Scheme, which is more minimal. And I think we have some of those, you know, this kind of tension also in Emacs itself. What should be in Emacs core? Should we have a lean Emacs core? Should we have more stuff in Emacs core? And I think these are, you know, good discussions to have, and there are you know, various challenges that are associated with each of those choices. I think what will never change is that Emacs is hackable. Emacs is customizable. This is the key strength. This is why we love and use Emacs. I think fundamentally, whether you do it a lot or not, this is what at core is bringing you that amazing user experience. However, the flip side of that sometimes is that it's so easy to hack Emacs so that we hack around bugs instead of fixing them. We do some tweak in our customer, say, okay, this is a little bit broken, let me just fix it. I'll put an advice on this function. I'll do this customization. Or we accept limitations in Emacs core. And I think it's fine. This will never change. That will always be core to what Emacs is, right? However, I think that the flip side of that is that I think sometimes we could be better at, you know, just taking those few extra steps to also make Emacs better itself and solve this for all users. And I think if we can build a little bit more of a culture like that, I mean, we already have that culture to a large extent, don't get me wrong, we do. But if we can get a little bit more of that culture, let's get that into core, let's get that problem fixed, that frustration. I can tell you that I just started a new assignment at work, I already told you. So I'm gonna write a lot of Python, okay? So I need to keep track of something called virtual environments. And that's just a way to install, you know, these dependencies just locally per directory or per repository kind of thing. And I've used various packages for that. There are like five packages maybe. And one is called VMv, and one is called virtualenv, and one is called python-vmv. And now I'm using a different one. And it's just a little bit, why doesn't this work out of the box in Emacs? Why? Like I don't think there's a really good fundamental good reason why something like that doesn't work in Emacs. So I think that's really, I'm sure there are other things like that, other fundamental features. Why is it that for the last 20 years, we've shipped Emacs with no PHP support out of the box? I mean, I'm not a PHP programmer. I don't really have a lot of love for PHP, let's say. It's a very funny looking language. But okay, still, it's been very popular. Why haven't we supported it? It's just strange. You install Emacs on some machine, you open a PHP file, you get fundamental mode. It's not the best user experience, in my opinion. So I think there are some things where we really could do a little bit better. And I'm seeing this all the time. This new assignment was interesting. There was this Emacs user. Turns out we had the exact same hack in both of our init files. So we had created the exact same mode for Dirrit actually to hide dot files. You know, dot something is supposed to be hidden on a Unix system. So we had Dirrit hide dot files mode to just hide them. And why isn't that in Dirrit? Or should it be in Dirrit? Should it be a package on GNU Alpa? Where should it be? Why is it just a local hack? Should it be on a wiki somewhere? I mean, sometimes that's the correct answer. Sometimes the correct answer is yes, it should be a package. Sometimes the correct answer is yes, it should really be in core. So what I want to promote is more like, let's just take a step back and just ask yourself, you know, what's the best solution if we look at the overall picture? Should I hack this into my configuration? In many cases, yes, that's the right thing to do. We don't want to proliferate just random solutions all over Emacs for no reason. But sometimes we want to fix it once and for all. We want to do that in core. So you could send stuff like that to us as patches or as packages, and we can discuss a little bit about where should we solve this. What's the right level of abstraction? I'm seeing that I'm running out of time. I had an Emacs wish list. Maybe we can take more of that in the Q&A. But I want to say, like in VS Code, you just start VS Code, you open a Python file, and you get like, hey, oh, you're trying to use Python? Click here, install Python. You get all the nice things out of the box. And my argument is, why can't we have more of that in Emacs? I don't think it's necessarily hard, but it does take a little bit of work. The challenges here are more social, I think, than technical. And I think it's worth doing because it's not just Python. It's just there are always these small things where it just really should work, and that would be a much better experience. And then you could customize not that thing that should just work, but you could customize more fun and exploratory things instead of people reinventing the wheel over and over again. So I'm very excited about what's happening in Emacs. I think we should be proud of what we've accomplished. It's so many things to many different people, an environment for hacking, just a productivity system. Other sees as a different way of looking at computing, you know, the embodiment of the ideal of the Lisp machine, if you want to talk big words and stuff like that. And of course, Emacs are all those things and so many more. And that's what makes Emacs so amazing. And in some sense, we should be care that people are satisfied with using lesser text editors. How could they be happy running that? I mean, I'm sure it's fine, but it sure as hell isn't Emacs. So don't we owe it to the world and to them and to ourselves to make a great Emacs. That will be my ending words. And I hope to see you all in the Q&A. Thank you all.
And thank you so much, Stefan. That was a wonderful presentation. And I just want to give you the opportunity. You said that you perhaps had not the practical stuff, but you wanted to do a demo or something like this. What did you mention exactly?
We didn't have time, really. Yes, I'm not sure. I didn't prepare anything so that we can do it live. But maybe for next time, I will do a demo. Don't hold me to it. But or someone else could. That would be really amazing.
Right. Well, thank you, Stefan. You've been already into so much detail of so much of the intricacy of the maintenance. And as someone who's been 95% of the time developing for Melpa, I feel like this talk was very geared to a lot of us who tend to experiment in this Cambrian stage of Emacs evolution, where we get to deploy a lot of creativity whilst also feeling pretty agile in a way we come up with solutions to problem. But some, you know, you've won me over with your discussion about potentially moving some of this stuff to core. And I think this particularly resonated at the end with this tension that you feel about problems that you encounter. Do you fix them in Melpa? Do you fix them in core? Is it not something that is supposed to be an option? Like, I love this tension. And it's something that we've been exploring for the last three editions of EmacsConf. It's really what is to be the interaction between this pool of very clever developers who are on Melpa, but who are perhaps a little bit afraid of joining core, and the wonderful job that you do that, yes, seems archaic from the outside, but as you've been at length today in your presentation, is actually just a better way to work, a very pragmatic way to get a lot of work done. So thank you so much for your presentation.
Thank you, Leo.
So we have about 12 minutes now to go through as many questions as possible. You have obviously had a lot of questions throughout your presentation. Do you have access to the pad, or do you want me to share the question and feed them to you?
Yes. Could you start with sharing them? I'll see if I can get it on my screen.
Sure, I'll do that. Please let me know if my microphone is clipping, because my OBS setup sometimes is a little bit janky. So, but I'm going to try to read the questions for now.
It's clipping, but I can hear you okay.
Okay, so bear with the clicking. We'll switch as soon as possible to Stefan reading the question. But I'll read the first one. Can you tell us some more, I assume, about your background with Emacs development and programming in general, your professional work, possibly?
Yeah, sure. I studied computer science at university. I started programming on a Commodore 64. I started with BASIC, and then I did a couple versions of BASIC as a kid. But then really things took off when I started using GNU Linux. I can't remember which year. Maybe it was, you know, early 2000, you know, something like that, late. No, it must have been before that, actually, because I remember I was 14. Yeah, okay, so let's say 1999, 1998, somewhere there around. Then I started with Perl, and I did Perl for a good long while. I learned C++, I learned C, I did all kinds of stuff, and then I went to university, computer science, and I've been working, you know, in various roles. Right now I'm coding Python. Up until last Friday, I was writing firmware in C for a small microcontroller, which is pretty different than writing Python, that's for sure. So yeah, so that's a little bit about me. I got interested in free software, you know, also at a very young age. So, I mean, I've been following these, you know, ideological discussions and debates, read all the stuff by Richard Stallman and so on and so forth. But yeah, that's it.
Great, thank you. I'll move on to the next question. You'll have to listen to me because if I start sharing my screen again, we're going to get some clicks. So the question, do you think that one day there will be a native... Do you think that one day there will be a native graphical web browser in Emacs, or is it kind of against its philosophy and architecture? So will we stick just with EWW and EAF or similar workaround tricks?
So if... I don't know if people have seen... There is a talk by, I think, Perry Metzger. Is that the name? Sorry if I got the name wrong. Perry Metzger, I think. And it's like Emacs, a text editor for the next 40 years. He makes an excellent point there that one of the things that we need to do is really get, you know, a proper HTML rendering in Emacs. It's like a dream at this point. No one is actively working on something like that. I think that, you know, there... first of all, you'd need to rewrite the display engine. So that's a big job. It is. I'm not saying, you know, it can't be done, but you need to start there, right? Second of all, you need to think about, you know, with all the Emacs Lisp code out there, is really assuming, you know, one paradigm, which is that you have a square, and basically you have columns and you have rows, and everything is in there. Even images is basically in a column, you know, in a column on a row somewhere. Whereas, you know, when you just start talking about web stuff and web rendering, you will already have like a C plane. You have a different types of geometries that are possible. And what does it mean to go to the logical next line in that kind of sense? I mean, these types of things, I'm not saying it can't be done. I'm saying there are definitely some challenges there. It would be amazing. I mean, but we need someone with, you know, the inclination and talent, I think, to work on that.
So that's a job posting if I've ever had one. So good luck to whoever's willing to apply for this one. I think it's a tough one.
It is. Yes.
Go on. Okay. Do you happen to have the questions in front of you? And can I just read them to you, and so that you can also have a feedback in front of you?
Yes, I have the pad here.
Okay, cool. So I'll read the next question, and this way I don't have to worry too much about me butchering every word in the sentence. So Emacs development and communication still is very much focused on email mailing list. I like this, but what do you think about introducing other channels for talking to users, like the Emacs project community could set up a Mastodon instance for instance?
I think from the point of view of the Emacs core team, we don't really have a lot of resources or people inclined to be working on stuff like that. But I mean, there is so much going on. Emacs is a very, you know, it's a big community, to frankly, right? So people working on Emacs Conf, there are people in you know, the IRC channel, the Emacs IRC channel, there's the Emacs subreddit. And I mean, people are doing an incredible job. And I think if people want to do more stuff like that, I mean, don't wait for Argo, just go for it, you know?
Great. All right, moving on to the next question. Sorry, I'm not commenting anymore because we have so many questions, and I'd love for you to answer as many people as possible because we have about 6 minutes technically, but we can go perhaps a little bit over. If you have the time, Stefan, though.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So what are some features or packages you'd like to see developed by the community? We've already talked about the native HTTP display, but do you have any others?
Developed by the community. It depends what you mean. So do you mean sending stuff that people could be working on in general? I think for now, like, let's say the roadmap, I'll just give some of the things that I think should happen right now and that I would love for people to send patches for. That's what I'm going to be answering because that's what I think I can answer. Tree sitter is a new thing, right? Improving and working on new modes for, you know, tree sitter. It's not very hard. I think many people could get into it and make sure to integrate the Emacs core. I think that would be, I mean, on my wish list. The other thing that is that we've asked for someone, perhaps with a little bit more experience, I think, but, you know, working on refactoring capabilities in Emacs and a more general framework, I think for that. There are probably many more ideas that, you know, I could give people, but those would be the two big ones, I think, that are also very uncontroversial.
It's funny because for me, I don't think refactoring would count as a feature, you know, but it's so vital to allowing further features to be developed. Otherwise, I remember the way OrgMode used to be before we had org element and stuff like this. It was really complicated to write any kind of parsing stuff for it. And now that we've got it, it just opened up a world of possibility where parsing an OrgMode file is just made so much easier. So I think that's a wonderful answer because it goes, it's multi-layered, as you would expect from something that concerns the whole of Emacs. Moving on to the next question. What is the hardest decision being made within Emacs dev for the last three years? I'm not sure. Is it the decision in the last 3 years? Or I'll let you interpret the question however you want.
Okay, well, I'll say this. I started in August, and I haven't had any really hard decisions so far. So good news. Maybe Eli will have more for the last 3 years. Keep it simple.
Right.
Thanks.
Cool. Next question. Any plans to integrate XWM into core? Emacs is a really good Windows manager.
That's super cool. I think EXWM is cool. I think they need to upgrade to Wayland somehow, and that's not clear yet. But, you know, we don't have any current plans to integrate it, no.
Right. Next question. Do you think it is a good idea to choose OrgMode for writing documentation instead of tech info?
I think that whatever we do, it should be the people that are working on the documentation that should make that choice. Currently, we have, I think, Modus themes, and OrgMode itself is writing their documentation in OrgMode. That's fine by me. It has some drawbacks, it has some benefits, but most documentation is still in tech info. Maybe we'd need to replace that at some point. I don't know. But for now, that's what people know and use. And if you find that as a barrier to contribute to Emacs, I mean, just really write it as plain text. We'll be happy to help you with the markup. It's a little bit, you know, finicky and stuff like that.
Great. Thanks for that. Next question. What do you plan to work on in Emacs Core in the future?
I'm a little bit hesitant to reply to that. Of course, I have ideas. Of course, there are projects that I'm working on. However, if I say it here, I feel like, you know, then you'll hold me to it later and come ask, where is that feature? So I'll just say there is plenty of stuff that I'm working on. And if you want to know some of the stuff that I have been working on, check the Git log. I think that's just really as much as I want to say about that right now.
All right. You've had it, folks. Just look at the path with the change log, and that's all you need.
Right.
All right, moving on to the next question. What do you use Emacs for in your life other than working on Emacs itself?
Oh, shit. I mean, so the big thing is programming, right? Like, now I work as a programmer. In general, I use OrgMode heavily. I use it for all my writing. I used it to write, you know, prepare this talk. I use it as a productivity system. I use it for, you know, emails. I use it as an RSS reader. I mean, I do most of my computing. I mean, I also have Firefox. So it's like Emacs and Firefox for some reason. I do read documentation in Emacs as well in U. But yeah, so.
Great. I do very much the same thing with you. Like, you've described exactly what I do. I work as a programmer. I use OrgMode for a lot of stuff. And I think that describes a whole lot of people currently watching the stream. Moving on to the next question. What could we do in order to make Emacs more attractive for younger users?
This is an amazing question, and I feel like wholly unprepared to answer this. Probably more introductory material aimed at, you know, that age group. What do you mean by younger users? You know what would be really cool if you had like an Emacs for Kids project? That would be amazing. I'm not sure if that's what people are thinking about, but that's about what I can say for now. Good question.
It is a very good question. Like, it comes back always to a key topic in EmacsConf, which is, you know, how do we get more people to join us because it's a wonderful community? And how do we onboard people who are not programmers or people who are younger than the average Joe coming in those meetings? And
there's this excellent article by Paul Graham, I think, where he was describing how they used Emacs as the sort of customer service system. They built the customer service system for the early days of Amazon in Emacs Lisp. And then they switched and all the employees were sad. So definitely there's more stuff that could be done in Emacs and be done better in Emacs. So for sure, if people want to explore more stuff like that, that's amazing.
Yeah, and for people who weren't around earlier today, we've had presentation about how to get computer science students to use Emacs, and you know, trying to provide as much information and as much tutorial as needed for them to understand what is the philosophy behind Emacs and how it influences the way you work and so forth. So you might want to revisit this discussion. And we also have plenty of talks talking about this issue.
And I can just add that I think it's very important for us as a community to just be enthusiastic to get more people involved. Because, I mean, look, there's this meme where it's like, I use Arch Linux, by the way. I use Arch, by the way. And like, for some reason, people using Arch keep telling you that they're using Arch. I that's fine. Use whatever you want. It's free software. I don't care. But, you know, and I think if you look at Vim users, they're very almost militant. Oh, we're Vim and Vim is the thing. Emacs users sometimes, and it's fine. I mean, we take a bit of a more, you know, laid back approach. We're like, yeah, I use Emacs, I use Vim, whatever. You know, but and that's fine. I mean, that's the correct approach. I think you should respect what people want to use. It's, I don't care that people use VS Code or whatever. I'm not going to use that because it's too limiting. It's not really a workable environment. But I think it's okay to be enthusiastic. I think it's okay to talk about like that type of enthusiasm, and anything that can help, you know, increase the enthusiasm around Emacs can only help, you know, the longevity of Emacs.
I agree, and that's also one of the key objectives of EmacsConf. You know, it's about bringing a lot of amazing people to come talk like you about stuff that is very dear to you. And it's very tangible how much you care, all of you, about what you're presenting. And it's amazing to put all of you people on just 48 hours talking about all of this and then creating so much content for people to watch. And I think it's really helping the enthusiasm to live on and to gather a little more snow as it comes down.
Yeah, I watch EmacsConf every year. I think it's a lot of fun.
Thank you. Oh, I'll take the the compliment for everyone else in the team. Okay, we're going to go a little bit longer with the Q&A because we still have a lot of questions. And if Stefan is still willing to answer, I'm still willing to not go to bed to hear a lot more of us.
Me, it's fine. I have time.
Great. So I think I've done this question. So. All right, how are we going to make sure that a cool idea is going to pass it through for the next generation, let's say 20 years later, that generations still have the good knowledge we have today?
Yeah, so, I mean, if you think about what does Emacs need to have staying power? So in general, they say, you know, if when you start a company, if you have a company for 1 year, then in all likelihood, you're going to have it for 2 years because, you know, it's just, so if you've had Emacs for 4 years, I'm saying that we're going to have Emacs for the next 4 years as well. Just based on that, I'm not sure the logic holds up, but, you know, how does Emacs stay relevant, I think, is the question. Well, I think we need to continue working on all the types of, you know, exploratory work that people are doing in the community. I think there is fundamental stuff that needs to be done. I mean, if people want to work on, you know, web rendering in Emacs, maybe that's the next, you know, revolutionary step that we need that could, you know, really showcase what Emacs, you know, as you know, an idea, even if not Emacs as a software, could be. And, you know, because there is huge potential in the idea as such. So maybe that's something. But I mean, from the point of view of core development, I think we need to just continue working on, you know, the fundamental technologies. One thing that I would like to eventually see is a better garbage collector. We've talked about that for a long time, but we need someone to do the job. Really, it's not very easy. It's very hard, actually. So just continue working on stuff like that, continue with the exploration, continue like using and being, you know, excited about Emacs. I think that's the best guarantee that we have.
Yeah, and perhaps to echo something that you said earlier, the tools that you're using, like the emails, you know, they've been around forever, they will be around forever. Like this pragmatic stance on the tools that you're using, they might look staid from the outside, but ultimately they are what permits a sense of longevity to any kind of project you embark upon.
So also in a sense, I think that the expectations might be changing in the sense that, you know, when I started using GNU Linux, you know what the first thing I did was because I couldn't get Xorg to run. So the first thing you had to do was you had to compile your own Linux kernel. So you sit there and make menu config, and you like try to read it, and you've never done anything like this before. You know, I was just a kid. I had never been at this kind of, you know, whatever. So I had to start with that. And then you had to write the Xorg configuration file, and I had the patience for that. But nowadays, people have different expectations. You just install something, and it works, and we need to keep that in mind as well. So that's why I keep pushing as one of my, you know, big things that we need to build a more cohesive experience out of the box. Of course, that can be customizable. You shouldn't, you know, shoehorn anything in just for the sake of it. But you could get some things a little bit more for free. And maybe some of us that have our own configs and we've been doing this for, you know, 2, 5, 10, even 20 years, we could also see, you know, from the point of view of a new user that just installs VS Code, and then they click, yes, I use Python, yes, I use that, and then it just automatically works. You know what I mean? I mean, then could we get closer to that, perhaps a little bit? I think that would also help.
Yeah, I think that's what we call the configuration wizard. And we were talking about this, I think, a couple of years ago at EmacsConf. I can't remember if it was with Adam in the chat. Adam, I mean Alpha Papa, or if it was with Bastien. But I remember the idea cropping off. Like, it's either you get a tutorial for Emacs, a proper tutorial, or you get a wizard, or you get both, and then all is right with the world. But definitely cool ideas being evoked. I'm going to say I need to decree a time when we finish, because for me it is 11:15 p.m., and I think my co-organizers are also willing to end the day and go rest, because we've got another day to go tomorrow. So how about we take 3 minutes and 30 seconds to try to answer a little bit more succinctly the questions we've got left? How does that sound, Stefan?
Sounds great.
Cool. So I'll start reading the questions then that we've got left. So this one we've got. If you're willing to discuss it, what do you think about the recent controversy about use of CLib in Emacs call code?
Am I willing to discuss that? I have said my opinion.
Allow you to answer the question.
I have said my opinion on Emacs Devil, I think. And I think I understand, I think, the viewpoints of both sides in that discussion. It is true that some things, I mean, we have to think about it. There is a real problem, I think, when we have three different APIs for doing the same thing in Emacs. And could we make that a little bit better? I mean, perhaps we could, right? So that's about as much as I'd like to say.
Fair enough. I would have also accepted CL loops are ugly to write and they don't feel very lispy, but I'll take your answer as well.
Yeah, some people think that, and I understand that position as well.
Right. Okay, next question. When we find a bug in our Emacs, do we need to try to replicate it on our side version, on our SID version, sorry, then update all the usual Lisp package we use, and if we succeed to replicate the bug in this version, only then go to development version 30 and do the same, then only ask for assistance in reporting the bug we found. So I believe when they encounter a bug, are people supposed to go to master, to pull main, and just to make sure that they are on the latest version? Is this something that you require?
We don't require that, but we do try to encourage you to reproduce it on master if we think that it matters. Yeah, so if you can, that's even better. But if the bug is there in Emacs 29, maybe we want to fix it in Emacs 29.2. So the latest point release is also fine. Bugs in Emacs 28 at this point, like the previous major version, we might ask you to try to reproduce it on Emacs 29 because we're not planning more releases of old major versions. So that's the fundamental reason for that.
Great, thank you for your answer. All right, moving on to the next question. On branching off subthreads, I note that they are less visible compared to starting a new thread in practice. I am wondering if it is just my impression or something devs also observe.
Yeah, it's true. That's correct.
Lovely.
I don't know what to do about it. If you want more visibility, I guess just start the new thread. I don't know. I can only agree, really. I concur. That's true.
Okay. Next question. What about rewriting Emacs in Rust? Use Guile instead of Elisp. Multi-threaded Emacs. Make Emacs prettier and shiny. And of course, same defaults. Just kidding. We are spoiled children because you and Eli, Lars, and etc. do an impressive work. I live in Emacs since 2001. Thanks.
That's a good one. Same defaults. Well, all that's right. A discussion. Mentioned okay, well, thank you. Thanks for that comment. That made me chuckle.
Next question by the same person, I assume. The only downside I see with copyright assignment is that one has to disclose their real identity. Would it be a possibility to assign a copyright under a nickname?
Yeah, you don't have to say a real name. Just register some, you know, pseudonym. The FSF does need your real name, but that's kept private only. So feel free to reach out to assign at gnu.org and ask more about that.
Right. All right, next question. Do you think it is possible to reach an agreement on same defaults for better out of the box experience?
Yeah, so your saying is not my saying necessarily. So that's the fundamental problem that we're discussing here. I think it's a social, not a technical problem. We do change defaults sometimes, but I mean, there is also some staying power. So it's understandable that, you know, we can't just change them willy-nilly and then flip-flop between, you know, one or the other kind of thing. So it does take a little bit more time. But yeah, sure, we can and we do change defaults at times. But it's perhaps more slower than what some people would prefer, for sure. So that's, yeah.
Right. All right. We have two more questions. So will X widgets have a future, seeing the new bugs popping up in the latest X widget dev? I'm not sure if there was a rest of the question, but on X widgets, can you tell us a little more?
I'm not really following that. I mean, I'm not seeing a lot of development on X widgets currently. Some people have done, you know, work in fixing up a few bugs, but I think that feature really needs more love. So I think we need, you know, help is welcome, patch is welcome. That's what I can say about that. So.
All right. And our final question of the day. Have you voted for Emacs as the software of the year on the Tuxes by GPT Broadcasting? I did because Emacs 29 is great. Thank you.
Okay, well, good job voting. I don't know what Tuxes is on Jupyter Broadcasting, but I'll look it up and go vote. So
I wish I could tell you. I assume with Tux it might be something related to Linux, but that's as much as I can say. Yeah. All right, well, Stefan, thank you so much for taking the time not only to do a wonderful presentation, but also for answering all the questions of the community. Do you have anything else to add?
Just really thanks for all the questions and thanks for staying. It's been a long day, a long conference, so thanks for staying and listening to my talk as well. Really appreciate it. Appreciate the work you guys are doing behind the scenes, organizing, setting everything up. And really humbled to be a part of this community. So thank you all.
Well, I can assure you that no one, either in the organization team or the people watching now, felt like it was tiring to stay and listen to your answers. So thank you so much, Stefan.
Thanks.
All right, we'll get set up. We'll take about 2 minutes to prepare the closing remarks for the day. Will Stefan go? I think maybe some people are still in the room. So Stefan, if you want to stay a little longer, feel free to answer a question on BBB. We're leaving the room open, but we're just going to close the day because some of us need to go sleep. All right. Okay, I think people cannot hear me anymore. Or maybe they might, but Stefan, I'm going to say bye to you now, and I'm going to head out.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, Stefan.
Hey there, Stefan.
John. Hi, John.
How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Oh, doing pretty good. Let me turn my camera on here. Just have to allow it. There we go.
Well, hello there, John. That's it's the first time we've talked, but we've emailed a little bit, so quite a bit.
So, yes.
Yeah. So it's really fun when you don't have the sort of. I've seen your presentations on EmacsConf before, so I knew what you looked like. Mm-hmm. It was fun. I met Eli Saretsky at this GNU Hackers meeting / GNU 40 years. That was fun because I've never even seen him do a presentation. I don't think that's his vibe, right?
Right.
To do presentations. So yeah, it's always fun.
Yeah, I've only met him on Zoom several times now, but he's always enjoyable to talk to. I think the community would appreciate him, but unfortunately, they don't get to see much of him.
Yeah. No. 100% agree. Yeah. I think so too. Yeah. He's a very fun person just in general. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
and very nice. Yes.
Very, very nice. Yeah.
Like you, I also have my entire life centered in org mode. I use it so much. If it weren't for org mode, I don't even know how my life would be manageable.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's the same here. I can't really, like, I just do everything out of org mode at this point. Like, I open my agenda and that's where I have everything. And if it's not on the agenda, it's not in my life, it's not in my work, it's, you know.
my most recent addition to it was I've added org roam into my workflow. So now whenever I want to take, what I used to do is, you know, I accumulate lots of tasks, but I also accumulate notes, just like little snippets that I don't want to forget. And now I tend to accumulate those notes into org roam. So each one has its own file. I tag them sometimes. I move them into subdirectories sometimes. But in that way, they become more like documents. And so I'll maybe extend them in the future. And I use a lot of the literate, like Howard's post on literate DevOps. I love that post. I reread it, I think, once a year just to like get re-inspired because it's so good. And I've started using that a lot at work. Whenever I have long, complicated processes where there's all kinds of options of what you might do based on what you see, I just document it all in org mode. And I put the canned script things there. And then in the future, when I want to replicate that process, I just drive it from Emacs.
Yeah, I've read that too. I think it's a very good blog post. And I've tried doing, you know, similar things. I think for me, it's a little bit, I mean, you need to stay a little bit disciplined with it.
You do.
Yeah. And that's maybe sometimes when you're just a little bit rushed. Then, I mean, so it's sort of this kind of thing. So you do it once and then it's set up and it's better in the future, but in the moment, you need to set aside the time to do it properly. Like, that's sort of what I struggle with a little bit. But yeah, I've tried that too. And I really like that workflow. Just, you know, just putting shell scripts inside of an org file is so much better.
Yeah. Yeah. At the moment I have, I really only have two literate DevOps files that I use, but I use them at least every couple of days. And I think they've saved me so much time. I mean, I could have turned that process into a whole bunch of little shell scripts, but then I would have to remember which one to run at which time. And
Right. You don't have the documentation there, all that stuff. Yeah. And what people do is like, they just put it on a wiki and then you're supposed to drag, copy, paste into a terminal window, all that. Right. I mean, it's just so much easier to get done. Bam.
Right.
Yes. That's amazing. Yeah.
Anyway, great presentation. Thank you so much for all of that insight into what the processes are.
Yeah, I don't know. I felt like it's always hard to know how it will come out. And to, you know, but I was thinking that if you're already developing stuff on Melpa, then maybe this will help you take the step.
Right,
that was my idea of the target audience kind of thing.
Right.
So, yeah. So where are you? You're in the U.S. Where in the U.S. are you?
I'm in Sacramento, California.
Sacramento, yeah. Where? So you work, I guess, you work with Haskell, is that right?
I work primarily with Haskell. I'm at a company where pretty much everything we do is in Haskell. Recently, I was doing Rust professionally. So it hasn't been long enough yet for me to forget my Rust. I still do like that language. I also use modeling languages, so I do use Calc a lot for doing proof systems. So I model software, like I draft a sort of the idea of the thing that we want to build, and then I can write theorems against that idea and see whether things are sound, if they hold. So I still do that quite a bit as well.
That's really cool. Yeah, I did a lot of Haskell in university, so
okay.
I really love Haskell, yeah, but. I never got, like, I never did any real work with it or anything like that, but we did, you know, most of the projects in university. We wrote, Haskell is amazing for writing compilers and stuff.
Yes, for it's sure. Really,
so much better.
Yeah. We're rewriting, we have an evaluator for a smart contract language and we're rewriting it. So like, just, oh my gosh, that it as great as it is for compilers, it's even better when you get a chance to then rewrite that same compiler and you can undo all the mistakes and all the inefficiencies that you did. But yes, Haskell is the perfect language for compilers.
It is. It really, really is. Yeah. Best experience I've had with writing compilers, for sure. So much better than the Emacs Lisp.
Yeah. Well, did you see that I created that library to try and capture the Haskell parser writing experience in eLisp? The Emacs Parsec.
Yeah, I haven't looked into it, but yeah, isn't there a Haskell library called Parsec as well?
Yeah. And yeah. I usually write my parsers in Haskell with Parsec. Actually, I use Megaparsec, but it's the exact same interface. So that idea of like, you write the parser, you write the parser as if you're building the data, and then it kind of like builds the data around what it is that you parse. I love that. I love that metaphor of how Parsec works. It works actually halfway decently in eLisp, but it's just not very performance. It's not very.
Yeah. Efficient. Yeah. Yeah. We had, I have actually not looked into it. How does it compare to something like pcase?
Oh, it's very different from pcase. So pcase is destructuring data and then writing a pattern match against it.
Right.
And so Emacs Parsec would be where you actually write the parsing constructions as if you were building the data from what you're parsing. Here, I'll give you an example. So somebody else kind of took the idea and ran with it. I'll paste it into the BBB chat here. So they give you an example of a CSV parser down at the bottom of their README file.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. Write a parser, a simple CSV parser.
Yeah, exactly. And so you can see it's really, I mean, what would you use pcase for with a CSV? I mean, you wouldn't, right? You would use a CSV library. But if you want to parse CSV, that means you've got a token stream coming in and you need to, gotcha. I guess what you're doing is you're deconstructing the token stream in a way.
Mm.
But you're doing it in a way where you're incrementally consuming it as you deconstruct it. So I guess that's the part where pcase has the liberty of deconstructing a whole thing, whereas Parsec is trying to deconstruct a stream. Those are kind of different paradigms.
Right. Yeah, that's cool. So it's like both, but okay. Yeah, I'm trying to think in terms of lexers and parsers, and I guess it's doing both lexing and parsing here.
I think with the Emacs version of it, the stream that you're running against is always a character stream. You know, it's just the contents of a buffer. So yeah, it would be doing both, but they call this combinator style parsing in Haskell
world. Cool, that's fun. Maybe something to look into.
Yeah, sure. I mean, maybe it has a future. Who knows?
Yeah, made me laugh a lot when someone asked, "What about rewriting in Rust?"
Oh, you mean Emacs itself?
Yeah, did you listen to the Q&A?
Yeah, I did. I was here. I mean, the funny thing with Emacs is that it's old enough that people have now asked that question in reference to so many different languages.
Yeah, right.
I remember in 1997, everybody was up in arms with the fact that Emacs needed to be rewritten in Java. And why wasn't that project already underway? I'm go away. In 30 years.
That is hilarious. That is actually hilarious. Yeah.
Yeah.
So who knows what kind of staying power Rust will have. Yeah. But to be fair, Rust is a little bit better than Java. I mean,
yeah. But
Rust,
I mean,
is pretty good.
C has, I mean, it's got an ANSI standard behind it. It's got like a plethora of implementations of the language. It's got, there's just too much benefit from there are very few languages that are like that. Most languages depend upon a compiler that's from one or a very small set of vendors.
Yeah, you're right. Well, nothing is like C, really.
Yeah.
Or is there anything like that? I don't know. HTML, maybe. I mean,
let me think.
In terms of being as ubiquitous,
I mean, Pascal used to be, but it's not anymore.
Okay, yeah, sure. Pascal.
Common Lisp actually is exactly like this. They have a plethora of compilers for, and they have a good standard. They're just they're just a little, the environment for Common Lisp is a little bit odd as a fit for Emacs.
Those are good points, actually.
Those are the only ones I can think of.
Yeah, those are good points. Yeah, but it's not like, I don't know, like it's not like I'm against rewriting stuff in Rust or anything like that, but it's more, I think it's like the wrong question to ask, really. It's, I mean, of course, if you want to do something and then you're like, let's do it in Rust, it will be better in Rust. And then you're like, hey, I'm writing a new garbage collector. Here it is, but it's written in Rust. Okay, then now we're discussing something, actually, instead of taking, like, I don't know, some key map .c, but now in Rust. Like, that doesn't help anyone, really. So.
Yeah, I think in terms of, I don't know that Emacs would gain much in either performance or correctness from Rust, because it's already gotten so much battle testing, just because of so many users and so many things that could go wrong. So we know kind of it's a known quantity. What you would get from Rust, if anything, is it would make it harder for newcomers who are helping the maintainers to do wrong things. Like, there's just more safety net. But that's it. Like, I don't see that there, if you ported it to Rust today, I would press anybody to even notice that it had happened.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, so that, but that's what I've been saying. It's like, you, if you come with a significant new feature that is too good for us to say no to, then yes, we will consider that. But anything short of that.
And then when you go to the FSF angle on it, right, it's like the fact that their flagship application is built with their flagship compiler, that's kind of meaningful. To say that the flagship FSF application needs this third-party language compiler from the Mozilla Foundation, that's that. Now all of a sudden, you've bound your fortunes to this other company that is not the same philosophy.
Right. Yeah. And like the Rust compile, the LLVM, basically.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Yep.
Yeah. Good point. Yeah. No, I mean, I now use Rust everywhere that I would normally use C++, except for the C++ app that I maintain, because I don't want to rewrite it in Rust. Same reason for that you have. Like, I don't know. I spent so many months performance tuning it and getting the bugs out, and it's like I could go to Rust, but I'm not sure I would notice.
Yeah, that's the thing that I mean a lot of people don't consider, especially it's like as you say as well, okay, so you get Rust, but also Rust is not as easy as C. You pick up in an afternoon, right. You don't do that with Rust. You just don't.
No, not at all. Then you're going to have to deal with people on Emacs Devel having problems with lifetime issues. And like, okay, pointers can be bad in C, but that's really the most awful thing you ever have to deal with.
Yeah, that's true. So, but it made me chuckle when he asked that.
Yeah.
Rewrite.
And Rust programmers also have a tendency to pull in a ton of crates from crates.io. So it wouldn't just be using Rust to build Emacs. You would have to choose the footprint of Rust. Like, if you're only going to use core Rust and what comes in the standard library, that's not the Rust most people are thinking of. People are thinking of stuff that can includes like Serde for doing JSON deserialization and includes Tokio for doing asynchronous computation. It's like all these huge third-party libraries, and they themselves have massive footprints because the Rust community is really good at publishing and using packages. So I think the pack, like at a company I was at a couple of years ago, we had a big Haskell project that we ported to Rust. And when we finally went into production, I think we were using something like 250 third-party libraries. at the end of the day, right? Because of all the transitive inclusion, all those libraries. And every once in a while, we'd be like, okay, guys, we're clearly using three different deserialization libraries. Let's unify that into one just to try and get our dependency footprint under control. Because it spirals out of control really quickly. And that doesn't happen so much in C, just because that's not the way C programmers build things.
Yeah, but why do you think that is? Like, what? Like, why did you have three different like parsing libraries? Is it just, oh, I like this a little bit more, and then the other dependency developer likes this a little bit more?
Yeah, it's just three different people with three different sets of experience and preference. I think because C is a language that does not abstract very well, it doesn't pay to try and make a library that suits a lot of different people. Like when I used to work in C, and I worked in C actually more than I ever worked in C++, I tried a couple times to make sort of generic libraries like lists over any type, where you end up storing void star everywhere and then you have to cast it into what it is that you want. But the performance and the memory characteristics of them are always a bad trade-off. Like you just, for the abstraction that you gain, you have to pay a lot of cost. And so it always ends up better to, like in C, to build the thing that you need. You want a list of ints, you make a list of ints. Whereas in Rust, there's a lot more abstraction facility. So many of these libraries, you are using different kinds of abstraction patterns to give you a one solution fits many problems type of thing. So now it depends upon the individual programmer. Well, what kind of abstractions are they familiar with? Like what is it that they're used to using? And then they'll gravitate toward those libraries.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. I think the best example of something more general that I've seen in C is the linked list implementation in the Linux kernel. I don't know if you've ever heard of that.
No, I haven't seen that.
Yeah, I don't remember the details. I watched this presentation like 13 years ago. There was this Linux kernel hacker. He was here. I'm in Gothenburg, right? So there was this conference that used to take place annually here, you know, called it was Free Software Conference. So he came here, he had a presentation on it. And I see, like, he did most of this, like, most of this stuff happened in the preprocessor, really. So yes, there was like no runtime cost to using that. So that was nice. But then, I mean, a linked list, that's a simple thing, really, right? Yeah. So you can do something like that, but, you know, oh, hey, here's my red black tree kind of thing. Or, you know, something like that, it gets a little bit more complicated.
Yeah. And in fact, it was a red black tree that is the very example that broke me trying to abstract my library.
Yeah. You can imagine.
You're in Gothenburg?
Yeah, I'm in Gothenburg. Yeah.
I've been there once. I was there for the ICFP conference in like 2017 or 2018.
Right. Because you're involved in some standardization type stuff.
Well, I was involved in C++ standardization, but I went there for the functional programming conference. So I went there as a Haskell person.
Oh, ICFP. It's the functional programming.
Exactly.
Cool. Was it good?
It was very good. No, I enjoyed the city. I enjoyed the conference there. I think that the standards committee took me to Denmark once, but it never took me to Sweden.
But you got off the standards committee for C++.
Yeah, that was back in 2014. I went one last time to say goodbye to many of the old friends that I had there. But it's just, it's so much volume and detail that unless you're a compiler implementer, then it's hard to really keep abreast of everything that's going on. Because you and even the other people I knew who were really the experts who went, they themselves told me they only really know the clause that relates to the part of the compiler that they work on. And so a company will have multiple people come where each person is like, one guy is an expert at declarations, one guy is an expert at templates, one guy is an expert at expressions, you know?
Yeah. Well, it gets very, I mean, C++ is already a complicated language, but then it gets very complex. You sort of start digging down into these like very, very deep details.
Yeah. Yeah. It's unreasonable how complex it is.
Yeah. Oh, you mean the language?
Yeah. The language.
Yeah. I always like to think about the fact that templates are Turing complete.
They're actually a pretty decent pure functional language. They just they lack a reasonable syntax is the only problem.
Right. It's pretty funny.
There was a guy once, I don't know what ever happened to the project, but he wrote a Haskell to C++ template meta language compiler. So it was a subset of Haskell, of course, but you could write an algorithm in Haskell and he would generate the C++ template magic that would be needed.
That is hilarious. That is funny.
Yeah.
That's really good. That's really good. Yeah, I don't know. I think for now I don't really want to say, but I'm actually looking into a little bit alloc.c on the garbage compiler a little bit. It's such a huge project. I can't really stop in the public setting. Yo, I'm looking at the garbage compiler.
And
everyone's like, oh, you're gonna, you know what I mean? The expectation is just too big. For now, I'm just looking at it. Just familiarizing myself with the algorithms and stuff like that. And it's that's fun, actually. Yeah. It's been fun looking into.
So what style is it? Is it like Mark and Sweep, multi-generation?
Yeah, Mark, it's actually interesting. It's Mark and Sweep. So it's the basic, most basic one that you could have, really. Mm-hmm. But that's obviously lock the world.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you don't want to stop the world garbage compiler, then basically there are various ideas for how to do that. One idea that they've used in Go, and actually Andrea Corallo was the one that suggested this to me, you know, the guy who wrote native compilation stuff.
Right.
He didn't suggest it to me, but he suggested using a tricolor garbage collector instead. And that's an algorithm that could actually, I mean, it's incremental. It's not concurrent, but it can be concurrent, but it's incremental.
Right.
So you can just stop it at any time. And basically it has worse characteristics when it comes to throughput. Mm-hmm. So like efficiency, right? As compared to a generational garbage collector would be better. But in Emacs, we don't care about that. Really, we care about responsivity.
Right, right, right.
And if we can make it more responsive, then okay, it can be a little bit more inefficient. You have to redo some work maybe that a generational one wouldn't, but a generational one is much more complex. And the tricolor algorithm, actually, I mean, it was described by Dijkstra in a paper and some others in a paper from 1979. It's not that hard. The paper is not that long. If you go through, you can go through the proofs in a day kind of thing, half a day. And you have the basics and Google Go has used it and had some great results where they're we want to have responsivity of 10 milliseconds at the most. I mean, we don't want to stop for longer than 10 milliseconds for any given, you know, garbage collection pause. Why 10 milliseconds? Because that's what a human being can perceive, really. So that's what they did, and they've been able to mostly reach that. Obviously, there's a lot of tuning going on and they have to tweak a lot of stuff, you know, to just make sure that it's all good.
Yeah.
So it's not like a, you know, silver bullet or magical solution, but it does perform. I think it would perform, it should, let's use that word, should perform better than the Mark and Sweep one for sure. Mm-hmm.
Does the current garbage collector have like a nursery for reusing conch cells?
I actually, I don't think we don't really have anything like that. I don't think I'm really studying this on a very, I'm doing this a little bit, maybe I'm going about it the wrong way. I'm working on my garbage collector stuff completely outside of Emacs mostly, and just writing small experiments and reading this stuff outside, because the Emacs code, it gets complicated and messy and you get bogged down in all the details.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm trying to just get more fundamentals there.
I think.
Sure.
Well, the only reason
Andrea is so talented and he's also working on something like this, but he said unless he can work full time on it, he doesn't want to take on another huge project like that.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't know if I can take on a project like, I mean, there's, I mean, it's a resource thing, right? Do I have the time or do I not have the time? I have the interest for sure, yes. As he, but who will have the time kind of thing. So, right. So I'm just trying to catch up really with, there's this book called The Garbage Collection Handbook, which is
nice. Well, the only reason I ask about consells is because, like, there's the general case garbage collection problem where you're just asking about, you know, I'm freeing allocated things and I want to return them to the heap as easily as possible. And then there's the particular case of Emacs where one of the primary use cases for one of the primary things that's causing allocator churn is when Lisp algorithms are building up lists for temporary reasons, like just to accumulate some result, and then they pop, you know, they reverse it, they pop off the top, whatever. But they're creating these kind of temporary lists in memory and discharging them
a lot,
like very frequently. Mm. So if you do, if you look at GC statistics when running something like GNUs, most of what GNUs is doing is in-memory surgery of a whole bunch of data sets. Strings, string reuse is not going to be ever very significant because the contents of the strings is always differing. And then some of the more exotic objects like hash tables and vectors and things like that. I just also don't see that being the primary thing that is being allocated and let go. But consells, if I had a way of saying that every time I freed a consell, Emacs would hold it for reuse, then the odds are that very soon after that, I'm gonna need a consell. And I don't want to have to allocate a consell because I likely have a consell that I just freed a moment ago. I don't know if Emacs already has an optimization like that, but
it's an interesting idea, because when you start talking about nurseries, I started thinking about, you know, generational garbage collectors, yes. Right? But this is just a little bit of a smarter mark and sweep one, and you could perhaps do this.
Yeah, like hold some objects for reuse rather than returning them to the heap.
Mm. Yeah, that would be interesting to look at. Yeah, because for sure, I mean, we do generate, I mean, certain workloads just generate, as you say, just tons of garbage and it's just freed immediately.
Yeah.
So yeah. I guess that's why generational GCs are also that good in general, because a lot of programs behave like that. So.
And that's what Haskell does too. So I work on a blockchain, and if you have our blockchain software go from Genesis to the current tip, the amount of data that moves through the Haskell garbage collector, I think last time I measured it, it was 74 terabytes. And all that's represented on disk is 100 gigabytes. But the amount of data being allocated and freed, so the heap size never went above 3 gigabytes. So all of this allocation activity was happening within a 3 gigabyte data set, but the churn of creating and discharging temporaries was so intensive that the garbage collector was basically taking up almost half of the runtime of the program. And of course, that actually is a performance bug when you're pushing too much data through the allocator. Because even though the allocator is doing a great job, why are you allocating? Like, is there a way to avoid allocating and throwing away temporaries?
Was that the solution that you went for in the end?
Yes. Yeah. Usually what I try to do is I try to get the total GC, the amount of data that goes through the allocator, down to like the megabyte range. If it's in the gigabyte range or the terabyte range, I always have to ask, what is the size of the data set being worked on, and how is the size of the allocated memory in relation to that? If it's 1,000 to 1, then I'm clearly wasting memory a lot.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, there are so many. I'm curious to know actually why there are so many attempts to write a new garbage collector. And it seems like XEmax, they just, at one point, some guy just did it. And then for us, it's like 5 guys have tried, and these are talented people as well, right? That have really gone for it, and then they just end up not merging, or
that's true. So I'm not true. Abortive projects.
Yeah, I'm not sure why why that is. I asked Eli, his take is that, yeah, people just never finished. And okay, yeah, that's fair enough. Maybe that's true.
Well, they like proving that the idea is possible, but that last leg of like performance tuning, documentation, like making sure all the bugs are out of it, it just, that is a chore. That's not where the exciting stuff is.
Yeah, debugging a garbage collector.
Yeah, not very fun. Unless you can make that garbage collector run also completely separately. So like you can create a virtual simulation environment for it and you can like tax it in all kinds of cool ways. So that you don't have to use Emacs's environment to drive the testing. Then that can be a lot more interesting because you can get way more bang for your buck out of the tests that you write.
Mm. Yeah, that's an interesting idea. So basically you'd have to write an entire thing just to test the garbage collector around alloc.c, basically.
Exactly. Yeah, you'd write a synthetic environment for it, and then you'd write a generator so that it could generate use patterns, and then just like push a billion different use patterns through it. I did this for a register allocator that I wrote. I built a little virtual machine with a virtual processor, and I had it allocate registers for that processor. And then I just started synthesizing assembly programs and asking it to solve the allocation problem for those programs. And then I had a verification condition that said, okay, the allocation is only correct if when you run it through the virtual machine, it never steps on itself. Like two variables don't try to occupy the same space. And that found so many bugs, and like the subtlest bug it ever found, it required 8.5 billion syntheses. Like I had to create 8.5 billion different assembly programs before the randomizer finally found a program that had a very, very particular like sequence of events that occurred that found an allocation bug. But I would never have been able to find a bug like that if I were doing it in the context of an actual compiler.
That's cool. So you're saying, some approach like that might work to debug it, because that's what I'm thinking. Like that's one of the things that makes the project feel a little bit intimidating, is you have this entire Emacs runtime and garbage collection is generally, you know, oh, I do something over here. Here's the bug. And then it shows up.
Right. Action. Right.
Disaster to debug is like, you know, and spending staring at code is not my idea of a good time. Always. You know.
Well, it was great to talk with you, Stefan. This has been great. I have to run now. Somebody else is pulling my attention away, but this was a good moment.
Really, really fun to talk to you, John. I hope to see you more. We need to sort out something with use. I mean, talking about more mundane things, we need to figure out what to do about use package at some point.
Okay.
Like the repository, I guess, should it be archived, or, you know, if we want to do something like that.
If you want to have another like face-to-face meeting next week or anytime coming up, I'd be totally open to that. I've got lots of free time this month.
Oh, you do? Yeah, I'll see where I'm at. Maybe we can touch base in a week or two, and we can try to set something up.
I'll give you my my number here in case you can find me on Signal or any other mechanism.
Yep, I'll text you on Signal for sure.
Okay, great. I will then talk to you soon. Have a great night.
Take care, John.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You are currently the only person in this conference. You are currently the only person in this conference.